The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Charles Arthur, sitting in while Alex is away recovering from a Christmas overdose. On today's programme, can old dogs learn new tricks? We perform a New Year health check on some traditional industries and find out how they're faring in the digital space. Plus, we'll have a roundup of all the week's big news stories with Josh Halliday and Michael Brunton-Small. That's all to come, so stay with us. Now, how do you discover the next book to read? You often get it from friends' recommendations, but what if you could get those recommendations from all over, including your social networks? Matteo Bellucci is chief executive of Anobi, which is the Latin for bookworm. Anobi is a sort of social network for books and book lovers, and the books can be ranked by any and all sorts of attributes: their topic, their author, the country they deal with, the time they deal with, their genre. There's an endless number of connections that can be made between any number of books. But, I asked Bellucci, doesn't cataloguing books in this way kill off the chance of the happy accident of serendipity?
When you go by comparison, you never come up with the unexpected book. You know, you don't have any serendipity. You find, you know, you read the biography of Margaret Thatcher, then read the biography of John Major. You know, you want to get something that completely out of your spectrum that can really surprise you. And you don't get that with algorithms, unfortunately.
How does Anobi do it in a different way? What's different?
We do it by letting people, readers, use the platform to create a topic system. So users can come to Anobi and they can create a topic about their favorite interest area. And in these topics, they can put in books that they think are important to, if you're interested in that subject. And we keep the system very much like Wikipedia open so that everybody else can come along and contribute other books and help ranking the books within that topic. So the model is that eventually there'll be a lot of topics that people have created, and by just browsing the topics, you'll be able to find the best selection of books within that subject matter.
So you're not using fancy algorithms to say these topics go together, or people like these books, or this person read similar books?
Not at this stage. We are quite skeptical about using algorithms for books, simply because the number of books out there is just phenomenally high. There are 16 million English book titles. So the probability of hitting a home run with an algorithm is fairly slim. So we just prefer to give a system for people to browse books in a novel way, so that they can follow new paths into sort of a browsing environment where they can discover new books by looking at other people's reading histories or by looking at topics that have been created by other users in the system.
What format do you produce your ebooks in? Because there's all sorts of different DRM going on for ebooks.
So we use these, what's kind of considered the standard, which is EPUB, and we use the Adobe DRM. It's kind of a forced choice in the market today if you want to offer the only available level of interoperability that you have, which means that with an Adobe DRM file, you can put it on most e-readers and read it on most tablets, excluding the Kindle. So Kindle does not allow you to read Adobe DRM, but everything else does.
The Kindle, though, is a pretty big part of the market, isn't it? I mean, it's very dominant.
It is very dominant indeed, because they came to the market very early and they had a pretty good solution, and they provided a very coherent and smooth user experience. So they definitely have a very dominant position on the market today, which is going to be interesting to see how we all jointly, the competitors, attack that.
How do you think the DRM on books will work out then? What's your expectation? Will this look like the music business or the smartphone business? How is it going to pan out?
I think that the DRM is something that, as you're rightly pointing out, the music industry is something that was adopted in the early days to protect the content. My hope is that this is going to be replaced with some sort of a clever watermarking in the near future, because DRM always acted more against the users than in their favor. And while in theory protects content, in most cases it's just a barrier between the end user and the content. And in fact, I think in some of the existing closed systems like the Kindle, it's actually used by these suppliers to almost lock in the user, because with the excuse of having DRM files, all the books that a person buys on the Kindle cannot really be taken out and read on another device. I think the DRM is a good thing, but it's misused and misimplemented, and has ended up backfiring on pretty much everybody.
It seems as though it cements the position for whoever is the market leader.
It seems to be absolutely that case. You know, we saw that with music, with Apple and iTunes, and now finally that you can buy songs in an open way. And I think it's much better for the market, because by having interoperable files, it becomes much more competitive, because people can be creative in the type of services that they can come up with.
What should we expect to see from Adobe in 2012?
We're going to spend the next 6 months polishing the system, because it's still in its infancy, the platform that you can see today on beta.anobi.com. We already have the end-to-end system where you can find books, buy ebooks, and read them on our iPad, iPhone, and Android apps. And we are looking for interesting novelties across the board. So one of the things will be the ability, for example, for readers to select a close group of friends on each ebook that they read on our tablets, so that they can share in their close network their comments and notes as they read the book, which we think is going to be very useful for book clubs and reading groups. But we're also looking at new business models, if possible, because we think the market needs a bit of a shock at the moment.
That was Matteo Bellucchi from Anobi speaking to me earlier. And if you're interested in Anobi, check out the Tech Weekly blog, where we'll have a link to them. Now, Josh Halliday and Michael Brunton-Spall are here to talk about this week's tech news. The first thing we hear is that text messages are in decline. Josh, tell us about that.
Well, isn't it what we always expected to happen, really, with the rise in iPhones and BlackBerry Messenger and WhatsApp Messenger, which are all free, of course, and we're all always connected to mobile data networks and Wi-Fi networks now. So why would anyone spend 10 pence or the equivalent of sending a text message?
I think the text message has been figured out to be the most expensive data you can send, bit per bit.
Exactly.
It's pretty much as if they're gold-plated. Do you have some stats on this? I mean, which countries is it falling in?
It's fallen in Hong Kong, in Australia, and even in the US, apparently it's slowing, but it's not actually fallen. In Hong Kong, it fell by nearly 14% compared to last year.
So, I mean, the US is actually the outlier there, in that it's a developed country, but the SMSs are still growing in use there, whereas in places like Finland, where text messaging was first picked up, it's actually falling. Michael, would you expect that you'd see text messages declining, really?
I would. I think the death of the text message has been long overdue. As you say, most of the younger people I know this year, I didn't get any text messages for the Happy New Year, whereas previous years I've got 20 from all of my friends. This year I saw all Facebook updates and Twitter messages, which is a far more efficient way of sending that out to your friends. It's a much better way, and it means my phone doesn't spend the entire evening buzzing. And you also don't get the effect at 11 o'clock at night on New Year's Eve that all the phone networks stop working because everybody's texting each other to say Happy New Year, and you get a text 2 days later. I'm quite glad of that. As you say, text messages are the most expensive way of sending that kind of data, but that means that the mobile phone operators are going to have to increase their charges if they're going to lose that revenue stream.
Do they have any use anymore, text messages?
No, not really. It's easy to get in touch with many more people for free online. I mean, we all know most of our friends are on either Facebook or Twitter, sadly not MySpace anymore. But that's just the easy. That's just the way people get in touch with each other. The amount of people who contacted me to say happy birthday this year fell 100% from one last year to zero this year. I got
You're just Billy No, mate.
Honestly, I got almost 50 messages on Facebook, most from people who I've never met in real life. But that showed the way it was going.
Now, you mentioned MySpace there. There's been developments over the Christmas and New Year period with the man who bought MySpace, Rupert Murdoch, and the strange tale of Wendy Deng. Josh, tell us what's been going on here, because this really is a complicated and curious tale.
If there was one thing that you would not expect to happen to Rupert Murdoch over the Christmas period, it would be to join Twitter. The man can barely read his on emails unaided, apparently. And so up he popped, sharing his thoughts on Steve Jobs' biography to US politics. And then soon after, so appeared his wife, Wendy Deng, or so we thought. until Tuesday, when Newsint decided to do an about-face on what he had said 24 hours previously.
Both the Rupert Murdoch and the Wendy Deng accounts had the verified tick against them. These were given the blue ribbon, a bit like a blue plaque, which says, yes, really is the person that it says here. So why did the Wendy Deng one have a verified one on it?
Here's where the big question falls at Twitter's door. How did that happen? Was it confirmed by Newsint? Because Newsint were themselves confirming that, apparently, that Wendy Deng's account was genuine on Monday. Did Twitter take that as read?
Well, you sort of would, wouldn't you? I mean, News International is, they're the people who are employed by her husband.
But the person who ever ran the Wendy Deng account says that Twitter never made any effort to get in touch with that person. Now, that shows a big lack of responsibility on their side.
Michael, what do you think? Is identity sorely lacking, or is she a sort of Schrodinger's cat woman who sometimes is and sometimes isn't Wendy Deng?
Identity on Twitter, again, is often hard. And my last understanding was that Twitter had actually stopped its verified program for normal people. You really had to have contacts high up in Twitter to be able to get a new verified thing. So only the top pop stars were being able to get it.
And which for Murdoch, who personally received his verification from Jack Dorsey on New Year's Eve.
I saw the Jack email was, or the Jack tweet was being retweeted all over the place.
And this is the way that verification really works in social media, is that somebody who knows the person knows that it is in fact the account. That mostly works, but then you get the issue of, is it a real account? And of course with Twitter you always have the problem of, are you talking of a business face account, or are you talking of a personal account, or is it some mix of the two? I mean, is Wendy's account a representation from the PR of News International, or is it her personal thoughts on everything that goes on?
One question remains in my mind. If Rupert Murdoch knew Wendy Deng was not on Twitter, then why did he remove the tweet that said that Britons were lazy and took too many holidays for a broken country? After Wendy Deng messaged him and said, Rupert, delete, that's rude.
Interesting question. Perhaps we'll find out. It's a bit like the Andy Rubin how to make Android tweet, which sort of mysteriously disappeared and then reappeared over the holidays as well, which is another matter. And of course that leads us into the question. Since we mentioned Andy Rubin, he tweeted that there had been something like 3.7 million Android activations, or 3.47, yep. I think it was, Android activations on December 24th and 25th. And when we put it together with Flurry, they said there was 6.8 million, I think. We're talking about a lot of, that's Android and iOS. And Josh, you've got some numbers about number of app downloads. There was a bit of a surge on the Christmas Day.
There was 80 million app downloads, according to Flurry, from the week from Christmas Day. So all these fresh new iPods, Android phones and iPhones straight out of the box were downloading all sorts, Angry Birds, iPlayer, you name it. iPlayer itself, according to the BBC, was downloaded 222,000 times for iPads, iPhones and iPod Touches on Christmas Day alone. That was up 4.5-fold on the previous day, and it broke all sorts of new records for them. Already an obviously a phenomenally successful app. It was 48,000 downloads on Christmas Eve, and it was 130,000 downloads on Boxing Day.
And Michael, since we're talking about tablets there with the iPad, Google is apparently working on an iPad, let's put it in quotes, killer, because Eric Schmidt has been said to an Italian newspaper that Google will have one of its own tablets in about 6 months or so. Now, he was heard saying much the same in April 2010. Nothing ever came of that. But do you think that we'll see a Google-branded tablet in the next 6 months?
I think it'll be really interesting. Obviously, with the purchase of Motorola, Google are now in a position to potentially build one. But yet, they've been in bed with Samsung to build some very, very good tablets in the past. I mean, the Galaxy Tab, both the early one and the newer 10.1, are very, very nice devices. And are the closest thing one can get to an iPad killer in the Android world at the moment. I believe the Motorola Zoom was generally considered a fairly good device, although there was some bones of contention about whether you really liked it or not. Google has clearly got its eyes set on beating the iPad, but most of the analysts seem to agree that Apple have got the luxury tablet market completely sewn up. Nobody has been able to compete with them. The only place that is open is the budget tablet market, and at the $99 price point, nobody can make a profit there, so the Playbook and the various other devices just aren't able to really get the foothold they really need from the users to be able to be successful.
Some of the murmurings I saw online early today on Tuesday were suggesting that this tablet would be looking to compete more with the Amazon Kindle Fire, which seems to have done quite well for itself. Though, of course, those Android activations will not include the Kindle Fire because it doesn't touch the Google servers when it's authenticated. We'll have to see how Amazon has done if they release any numbers for those sales. But would you see that as a more likely avenue for Google to go at?
Yes. I mean, the Amazon Kindle Fire is trying to sit in between the budget device and the luxury device. It's a little bit too expensive, in my opinion, to really fit into the budget area. The £99 that people really want, the Fire is $199, is it?
It's about $299 in the US.
$299. So the Amazon Fire is just that little bit too expensive for a budget tablet device. But also, lots of people have complained about the UI on the Amazon device. And I think my understanding from friends who've had one is that they are taking them back or getting rid of them or not using them because they just haven't enjoyed the UI. They haven't enjoyed the Amazon's view on what you want to do on a tablet quite as much as they have felt on the Android device, which, given how much the iPhone haters just dislike the Android UI, it's quite a shock to find people who think the Android UI is better than Amazon's own UI.
Interesting. So would you expect that we will actually see these things coming out of Google?
Yeah, I suspect that Google's strategy for building a device to match the Nexus phones, which have actually been very popular because they come with none of the bloatware that the manufacturers are putting in there and the carriers are putting into the devices. I suspect a tablet would do quite well in that market. The question will be whether they can actually build one that will match the build of the iPad and the iPad 2 and the iPad 3, because that is likely to come out this year as well.
It's interesting. I mean, I looked at the numbers from the Google market over the Christmas period, and my calculation suggests that there's about 4.7 million Honeycomb tablets out there, of all varieties of Honeycomb. So that's not very many when you compare it to the number of iPads sold, or indeed possibly the number of Kindle Fires sold. But we'll see. Now, next week is the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where Steve Ballmer will be giving the final Microsoft keynote there in the heritage that stretches back all the way to Bill Gates and sometime in the late 1990s. Now, I have high hopes that he'll round it off with a dazzling parade of Busby Berkeley dancing girls, a trapeze act, and perhaps a guest appearance by Penn and Teller. Though I have to say, I suspect I may be disappointed and he'll just go through how the Kinect is great and Windows Phone interface again. But unlike previous years, there doesn't seem to be the same buzz leading up to the CES show. Last year, there was Android phones, there were iPad expectations, and there were tablets aplenty, such as the then-unveiled, not quite unveiled, RIM Playbook. But this year feels different. Josh, do you feel that some of the air has gone out of the gadget market?
It certainly feels like the calm after the storm. I mean, there's none of the big players anymore, really, who haven't shown their cards, who everyone is waiting for. And there's nothing to deflate a market frenzy like Apple not being expected to release anything that's a killer of anything that's already out there. I think for the man on the street, they're largely disinterested after the overdose of excitement last year. I think that media organisations and publishers were quite interested in the Amazon Kindle Fire when it came out, just because of the impact Amazon has had on the publishing market. But I think that for the ordinary Joe, the sort of the interest is long since passed.
Michael, do you think that categories such as smart TV might make an impact? I mean, they were there a little bit last year, and 3D was also being talked about. Do you think this could be their year?
I've wanted a smart TV for years. Nobody has been able to build one that actually works exactly the way I want it.
How would it work if it worked how you want it to?
The biggest problem with smart TVs is actually not the technology in the TV itself. It's all of the deals they end up having to do with the different content producers. So you either end up with a smart TV that can show you the best of YouTube, which I have to admit is not something I particularly want to sit and watch for hours on end, or you find one that has links with just Sky, for example, but you can't watch any other cable channels or Freeview, or you have ones that link together with other media organizations like HBO or whatever in America. They're useful, but it's the content companies not making it easy for a smart TV to actually pull together, I want the iPlayer and I want ITV Player and I want 4 on Demand in the UK, plus I want YouTube and I want access to my Sky if I have it, or Virgin if I have that, to be able to set things to record and stream it. I want to be able to browse my Slingbox from wherever I am as well. And I want my network attached storage, which has music and stuff on it, to be able to stream it direct to the TV. And nobody can seem to combine all of the elements together, mostly because I think the licensing issues just cause them so much pain. And when they do it, the Microsoft Xbox has sold massively over the Christmas period in America, particularly because they've managed to do some really good deals. They've got the HBO deal, which is working really well for them. They've got Netflix on there now. They've got lots of streaming content and the ability to have something under your TV that really does generate a media center for you. However, in the UK, there's very little that you can get at the moment. The iPlayer is rumored to be coming, but it'll only be the iPlayer. There's no mention so far of 4 on Demand or ITV Player coming. And you just start to see this patchy area around content providers not really being willing to just allow their content to be viewed wherever anybody is. And that's something that needs to be solved before internet TV can really take off.
Well, we're expecting the Netflix launch, aren't we, within weeks
in the UK. Yes. I think I've seen some adverts for that already. So yes, they're starting to push that. But I mean, when you're talking to your friends, are there things that they're saying, come on, Josh, you know, you work in this technology stuff. Are there things that they want to see that they're looking forward to?
Well, I had a friend who bought Apple TV in November, and they were woefully disappointed that it didn't include any TV shows whatsoever. The most recent thing it included was movies that were probably 18 weeks old. It's not the greatest attraction. Yes, you can hook your iTunes up, and yes, you can play music and YouTube from your iPad or your MacBook, which is nice. It's a novelty factor. It's nice to show off to your friends at parties, and it includes no end of fun. But it's not a seamless experience. You can't watch live TV. If you want to stream the iPlayer, you have to hook up a HDMI cable to your iPad, which for a lot of people, I suspect, is just an inconvenience too far. And I mean, 4OD, you can hook it with a HDMI cable again, I think, but even with Sky Go, like you said, with the licensing restrictions, there's no way to stream that via Apple TV. You get the sound, but not the picture, and you're forced to watch it in this sort of dual surround sound awkward way.
So very unsatisfactory.
It is quite unsatisfactory.
It's quite sad to think that the best media center experience I've had so far is using the open source XBMC project on a PC underneath a monitor in my front room, which worked really well because it had plugins that you had to agree that you weren't breaking copyright honest, but allowed you to stream iPlayer and ITV and all the various different online services because it was open source and there was no legal liability for it. But commercial providers just don't seem to be able to get that together and do it.
Michael Brunton-Spall is available to come and fit it underneath your TV if you want. So thanks to you both very much. I'll be wandering the soulless halls of the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas, searching for the lost gadget next week. You can read up on these stories and the latest headlines throughout the week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Chad Dickerson is the chief executive of Etsy, a marketplace for handmade and vintage supplies. Recently, they reported 25 million users and a billion page views a month, and they're making inroads into Europe, with new stores opening recently for Germany and the UK. So with North America and Europe conquered, Chad met up with Alex Kotowski to explain what he plans to do in the East.
We thought Germany would be a good place to start because Matt Stinchcombe, who was employee number 5 at Etsy, who's actually in the studio with us, married Benedicta, his wife, who is German. And we felt like Berlin itself, it's almost very much like Brooklyn was when Etsy started. So Germany made a lot of sense from a cultural perspective. But from a technical perspective, it also, the language itself is challenging. You know, some of the words are really long. So we solved a lot of the problems and design challenges of going into a different language. And now we're going to be able to go into other languages much more quickly. So Japan and China are a little bit further out, but you'll be seeing Etsy increasingly around the world. We're already doing business in 150 countries.
Tell me a bit about the culture. You alluded to it when you said, you know, Berlin has the same vibe at the minute as Brooklyn did when Etsy was started. What do you think encapsulates the culture, the attitudes, the ideologies of the system?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, it's really a maker culture. And so I think it sort of goes from the inside out. So when I say inside, I mean inside Etsy, the company. So there's Etsy, the larger community, but you know, sort of a subset of that community are actually the people who work in the company. So we do things like craft nights where we bring people in to make things in the office. But we've also, even within the engineering team, we really talk about code as craft. So even the work that we do inside Etsy is making things. So Etsy.com is the thing that we're making. And we see technology and the tools we use as sort of the materials that we make our crafts with. So it's a very hands-on company. Like I, you know, as CEO, when we did the Hello Etsy conference, I was helping move tables and that sort of thing. So it's very much a roll up your sleeves, get your hands dirty culture. And everyone really focuses on continuing that.
Well, the proliferation of making cultures, you could probably argue that it's twofold. First of all, the digital technologies allow you to replicate things infinitely. Mm-hmm. And so that maybe increases the value for things that perhaps have a stitch out of place. But also there's the oft described age of austerity that we're in. Mm-hmm. What do you think has propelled Etsy's success?
For a lot of people in the world today, definitely in the United States, there are people who are out of work and people who have less money to spend. So I think Etsy sort of provides two different things. If you're someone who's out of work and you want to do work that has meaning, and maybe you've been laid off from a corporate job or you've quit a corporate job, Etsy actually provides you a venue to be an artist and an artist who sells things. And one of the most gratifying things that I hear from Etsy sellers is, people who come up to me and say, I was laid off from a job, I worked in a large company, I'd always told myself that I was an artist, and now I listed something on Etsy and someone bought it, and so now I am an artist. So I think we're not only, helping people make money, but we're also sort of feeding their souls and making them feel like better people. I think on the buying side, if you're someone who has limited money, you still want to do things like give thoughtful gifts to your friends. And I think when people have limited money to spend, they like to give special things or buy special things. And I think Etsy, because everything on Etsy is unique and has a story, it's just really appealing in that sort of environment.
But at the same time, and this could be a bias, having been an Etsy customer for a long time, is it does feel like quite an insular community. It feels very much like the whole maker community is insular, looking, focusing inward on itself, primarily from geeks, early adopters, technologists. How has Etsy seen this shift, or has Etsy seen it shift on a kind of societal level?
Yeah, I actually don't see it as an insular community at all. And I grew up in a small, relatively small area in North Carolina in America. And, now I live in New York and I lived in San Francisco for a while. And pretty much wherever I go, actually was with my mother who wanted to go to the mall in North Carolina. And I went to the mall and someone saw a t-shirt I was wearing. And she said, "Hey, I love your t-shirt." And I went over to talk with her and she didn't know I worked for Etsy, much less CEO of Etsy. And I started asking her if she knew about Etsy and she said, "Oh yeah, like I totally know about Etsy." She was actually a seller and a buyer. So I think from a sort of geographic boundary perspective, Etsy is everywhere. I hear a lot about young people on Etsy working with their mothers and grandfathers to learn new skills that are being passed down. So I think it's actually, in my mind, it's like the opposite of insular. It's really sort of going back to roots that are shared across many cultures and many people.
What's interesting, though, is the decisions that you've made within the company. So I think it was last year there was a brouhaha about Etsy's decision to link real names and real identities with the online identities. And since then, you've stopped that, haven't you? You've said that the two can be separate.
So we never went sort of all the way with that. I think that identity is important on Etsy, basically knowing who you're buying from. And that doesn't necessarily mean knowing their real name, but it's more about knowing, where something was made and how it was made and sort of where they got the materials and things like that. So we're really focusing the company on providing a sense of warmth and identity in the transaction, but that doesn't necessarily mean calling someone by their real name. So just for example, I was meeting a lot of Etsy sellers and people in the Etsy community when I was at the Berlin conference. And one of the sellers, her seller name is Banana Strudel. And so whenever I spoke with her, I called her Banana Strudel. And that's obviously not her real name, but that's sort of her identity and her brand. And I think that's just as well.
How big is Etsy now? How many employees do you guys have?
So Etsy's about 220 employees.
And what was the rate of growth of that?
We've grown quite quickly in the past year and a half. So, I came over as CEO from the engineering side, so I know that best. And we grew from about 25 engineers in early 2010 to about 85. And so that grew a little more quickly than the rest of the company. But the sort of surface area of the work that we need to do at Etsy is fairly large, sort of behind the scenes. So we've been growing to meet that demand. We're not necessarily planning to grow for the sake of growth.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, because certainly under your watch, if over the past couple of years you guys have grown so large, I've seen other startups that have had success that have just, you know, they've rocketed it, or they've ballooned in terms of numbers,
right,
and then they've collapsed in on themselves because there's a culture within the community or within the office that shifts now that you guys have offices in different countries. How are you going to maintain that sense of you know, the Etsy within the corporate offices as the CEO?
We spend a lot of time interacting with the community in many different ways. So every Monday night, in the Brooklyn office, we have a craft night, and we have volunteers from all over the company basically interacting with the people who use Etsy. And I think that really sort of helps promote the culture. When you start as an engineer, and we're spreading this to the rest of the company, there's something called the Etsy store where we sell t-shirts and pins and everything that are Etsy branded. You actually have to run that store. So if you're not already a seller, and we have some sellers inside the company, you learn what it's like to be a seller. You know, I came from a large company, Yahoo, and you know, we were on a big campus in Sunnyvale, California, and one thing that we didn't do very often was interact with people who actually used the product. Like, we had to sort of import people into a testing room, and they were sitting behind a mirror, and it was very kind of antiseptic. And there wasn't sort of a natural interaction with the community. And I think the way we've designed Etsy, the way we run Etsy, promotes all sorts of natural interaction with the community. So actually going to a meetup here in London tonight just to chat with sellers. You know, we encourage everyone in the company to do that kind of thing.
That was Chad Dickerson, Chief Executive of Etsy, speaking to Alex Kratosky. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to Josh Halliday and Michael Brunton-Spall. Alex Kratosky will be back in the chair next week, while I'll be somewhere in Las Vegas. Yes, it's all glamour. My name's Charles Arthur. The producer was Matt Hill. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.